Welcome to Story Plus Audience, a podcast about creating stories that connect deeply with audiences.
And using that connection to build a long-term career as a storyteller.
I'm Jill Golick. I'm a screenwriter and digital creator.
I'm Annalise Larson. I work in digital marketing and strategy for media.
And Annalise, we're not alone here, are we? There's someone else with us too, our audience, the listeners. Who are we trying to reach with this podcast?
Well, this is a podcast for storytellers, especially in media like TV, film, web series, and all the myriad of ways that stories can be told these days. And the people who work with and support these stories and storytellers, from production and post-production to distribution to the people in funding and policy. Basically, if you care deeply about having our stories told and reaching a global audience, this podcast is for you.
And for you storytellers, you writers out there, we will have in every episode actionable items, techniques that you can apply to your writing right now. And so we're hoping to be useful to you in that way. So Annalise, why are we doing this again?
Well, from my perspective, I'm really passionate about trying to help creative people, storytellers, and the rest of them find a way to have a more sustainable creative life, a bigger picture of where their careers can take them. And I think that there's a lot of really huge opportunities in the digital space that allow us to do that. And I think when we're looking at the Canadian ecosystem in particular, that we really need sort of a story plus audience revolution in the way that we make and invest in media. I think we have a real opportunity to shift policy and funding and other kinds of support that the government and our creative community invests in and where they put their effort. You know, we all have limited hours in the day. And I think the smarter that we can get about the choices that we make about our creative work, the better and more sustainable our careers can be as creatives. And I think that the missing piece, we have so many good storytellers in our country, but the missing piece often is that audience piece. So I'm hoping the more that we can twin them and make them work together, the better we can all be. I think there's lots of room for all of us and a whole bunch of different perspectives on story that comes from Canada, because we are such a mosaic of culture.
Yeah, I agree. I feel like I'm very optimistic about this country's future in storytelling, but I do think this is really a very important piece to add. I come to this sort of for three reasons, I would say. The first is that I just think when you know your audience, you're a better storyteller. And I go back to the idea of reading a story to your kids in bed at night, and you put your arm around them and you cuddle up and they say, do the funny voice, skip the kissing part, do the scary part again, right? And you know your audience so well, and you've got that feedback that you're a better storyteller for it. And also there's an incredible pleasure in getting that feedback and knowing the audience and feeling their satisfaction from the experience. Then the second reason for me is that audiences have become so powerful, especially because of the internet, where they really have this voice that can be heard. And if they love your show, they're sharing it and spreading it the word, and they're better than any, PR team, and they can finance you. They can send letters to the broadcaster to get your next season picked up. Or of course they can destroy you if they hate what you're doing, but you know, they're powerful and opinionated and you want them to be your partner because they're so powerful now. And then I think the third thing is, in this country, we're always looking, when it comes to financing and production, we're looking for some guarantees that it will get watched and find a market. And one of the ways this is traditionally done is by putting stars into shows. And we don't have a lot of stars, but the reason we want a star is because we know that they'll bring an audience with them. So I'm always interested in other ways of bringing audience to a show, figuring out what those are so that, you know, somebody will give me that big, huge whack of cash to make my production. So that's kind of what I'm hoping to get out of it. And I know that every time you and I have a conversation, I learn a tremendous amount and I really feel like I'm a better writer for it. So I'm hoping to learn a lot.
Me too. I always like learning. And I think being able to have conversations with you about your process as a writer, I think will just make me better at the kind of teaching, mentorship, and strategy that I do anyway. And I really feel like you, that, you know, the audience is so powerful these days, that in them lies the real opportunity, because we have an abundance. We're so lucky. We live in this time of such great creative abundance. We have a million ways to find stories, to watch stories, to be entertained. But the only thing that is in limited supply is each person's individual, you know, amount of time, how they're going to curate the things that they watch. And so I think the better that we can have that connection, the better that we can acknowledge how powerful they are and use that to inform some of the strategic choices that we make, that overall, just collectively, we're all going to do better. And I think that in Canada, we have such an amazing abundance of different perspectives. We encourage people to bring their individual lived experience and culture to the stories that they tell. And there's such a hunger for that these days, that we want to see something that's different, that's not part of the monoculture that we've, you know, enjoyed in the past. Still space for that, obviously. Superhero movies are doing really well these days. But what's really exciting, I mean, my God, look at Parasite. It just cleaned up at the Oscars because it brought a very unique and distinct voice and story to the screen that was incredibly exciting to a lot of people. So yes, niche does not necessarily mean limited. It just means fresh and unique.
And that's very much an audience-driven thing. You know, they're driving this more, driving us away from the cultural, you know, monoculture and into a world where we're seeing more choice and more diversity. And I guess that's kind of the final beat of this, is that, you know, when I started my career, television was large, was an advertising business. That was the revenue for the industry, was selling ads. And our job as writers was to kind of keep audiences in their seats during those ads. We were serving the advertiser. And today, with the rise of streaming services and kind of cable subscription channels, the audience is paying their own way, and that's who we're serving. And so, you know, we have to reorient ourselves to the audience and to understanding them, and change our writing techniques to do that.
Okay, so we've talked in general terms about what our hopes are, but I think, you know, we need to make a case for ourselves. So I think we should each bring forward a couple of examples where you've seen this story plus audience combo work. Why don't you start?
Well, I just want to mention Fleabag to start with. I guess late last year, took home a whole whack of Emmys. Which was, it's interesting because of course Fleabag is, it's a small show. It's not huge budget. It didn't get a huge, you know, tremendous amount of promotion. It's about a woman who is definitely an anti-hero, and it's quite sexual and, you know, a little surprising choice to be such a critical favorite. And I think one of the reasons that this show is so successful is because of how well its creator and star knows her audience. And this comes from kind of working the material in front of live audiences at the fringe festivals. So it's difficult material, but she performed it so often in front of audiences that she knew where those connections were. And I would argue that knowing her audience that well is what led to its success and also gave producers and broadcasters the confidence to put a production like this into production, to greenlight it. We can't all work our material in front of fringe festival audiences. I particularly can't because I am not an actor by any means, but I think it just, you know, it points out the how important and how valuable knowing your audience can be.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, one of my favorite examples that I use all the time is actually from the web series world. Now, this example is about 6 years old. So, you know, the landscape for web series is quite different today. But I think it has to do with more episode length. So it's a very distinct kind of storytelling with these short episodes. And what was really interesting about the example that I want to use is it brought two audiences together to really create a phenomenon. So Lizzie Bennet Diaries is sort of a modern vlog, so locked camera shot, cheap for production, retelling of Pride and Prejudice. And it's all done from Elizabeth Bennet's point of view primarily. She's in control of the narrative. And what was really interesting to me is obviously this is a very beloved story. Pride and Prejudice has been retold a million times. If you, say, did some keyword research about all of Jane Austen's novels, and keyword research lets you know what people are searching for, Pride and Prejudice comes out head and shoulders above every other Austen novel. So you're already got the built-in audience of Austen fans coming to the table. Once they learn about it, they're gonna at least check it out of curiosity's sake because they love this. We love our Mr. Darcy. And it really made it a living, present, modern day thing, right? As opposed to this Edwardian kind of melodrama of its time. So that was one audience. The other audience came because one of the people that funded it, in fact, I think he was the first chunk of money in, is one of the Green brothers, Hank Green. He and his brother have a massive following through YouTube and other channels of primarily young women called the Nerd Fighters. The Nerd Fighters also came to it, and many of them didn't know about Jane Austen. They didn't know Pride and Prejudice, but they love these characters because the characters are so strong and eternal in many ways. And through this modern lens, it became new and exciting. I mean, this story rolled out practically in real time over a year. They dropped 2 webisodes a week. They had extended stories that were happening because the characters all had social media presence, where they would engage and with each other, but also with the audience in the story world. So it really engaged and deepened the connection with the audience by really inviting them to become part of the story world, to treat it as reality. At the very end of it, they launched a crowdfunding campaign and expected to raise, I think, $40,000 they were trying to raise. But it ended up, because people just had loved this journey that they've been taken on, they ended up raising over $400,000 American. So it's exciting.
But, you know, I mean, I guess the point here is that they really understood that audience really well. And I want to contrast that with a big, big, old media franchise. It's not that old. So I want to talk about season 8 of Game of Thrones. So here's a series. Here's a mega series. It's on HBO. It's got a massive budget. And it's got this incredibly avid audience that just that watches and rewatches every episode and is in the forums theorizing and guessing what's going to happen, who's going to end up on the throne. Their theories are so elaborate, and they've read every frame of every season in such detail. And along comes season 8, and the showrunners, who are called Benioff and Wise, they wanted to, I assume what they wanted to do was surprise the audience. They wanted to give the audience the ending that they weren't expecting. And so they didn't pay off all that work that the audience had done, kind of figuring out what was going to happen and investigating legends and, you know, tying disparate pieces of story together, and instead sort of changed the direction completely. And the audience was pissed off. They were so angry. I mean, there were huge petitions to have the season 8 remade. They were out to destroy the showrunners. They just totally turned on them. And like, I wonder what's going to happen to them. Like, do you think the audience is going to carry that grudge to the next project?
When you're playing in that genre space, especially around fantasy and sci-fi, people have very strong feelings about it, which can be to your benefit, but also to your demise. So I think it will be a while before they may want to be trusted, or maybe don't even want to deal with those fans. So maybe their future lies in another genre or in, you know, in a world that they create from nothing, right? That they create not based on a work that other people have made in the past and that people are already really passionate about.
But, you know, I think, you know, from writers' points of view, they worry that audiences have become co-creators with them. And really, we would like to be the creators and the writers and the storytellers and them to be the audience. But I think you have to pay attention to how the audience is consuming the story. And all that effort that went into understanding that story world should pay off. Like, it should, you should be building towards something so there's that logical ending for audiences. But, you know, when we used to be in the business of making television for ad-supported channels, the job was to create a story engine that kept churning out story forever and ever and ever, and you didn't really think about how it was going to end. But I think today it's really important for writers to know from the beginning how they're going to end their shows, especially if they're going on to these platforms that are driven by audiences rather than by advertisers. So that's my new number one rule is know the ending from the beginning. All right, I think we have another, you have another example.
Yeah, again, smaller and outside of the episodic world. It's a film that was crowdfunded and privately funded by a group of investors in the States. It is about real vampires. So not the sparkly kind from Twilight. There are people in our world who identify as vampires, and there's a whole culture around that. And the premise of this particular film is that the the vampires have set up a church and have applied and received charitable status from the IRS for all those tax benefits. And then they get audited. And it's actually a romantic comedy with a love story between the IRS agent and the head priestess, I guess, of the vampire church. So it's funny and, genre based. It touches on that kind of fantasy genre, though it is based in reality. There's not magic involved. And there's a huge appetite within that community for, again, to have, to see an authentic representation of their lifestyle and their culture. This is in a very different kind of way, maybe, than people might define and expect that to happen. But they've done this incredible, last summer, they did this incredible road tour, I think called the Joyful Vampire Tour, where they went to, 51 different cities across the states and turned, so it wasn't just a screening in their screening that people would show up for. It was a screening partnered in most cases with a vampire ball where you could dress up in any kind of costume. Apparently adults love to still dress up. We don't have enough opportunities to do so.
Dressing up is huge in fan communities.
Conventions have been built around that desire. This is a case study that is still unfolding. And they're really trying to find a model outside of what has traditionally felt like the path forward for film, which is festival, distributor, and then you move on to the next thing. Now that's not possible anymore. The distribution system for film in Canada, in the States, anywhere in the world is struggling a lot because people don't necessarily want to leave their houses anymore because we've got a million things that we can entertain ourselves with at home. So you really have to sweeten the pot and give something extra. And through an understanding of their audience, they were able to give them a show that encouraged them. It wasn't going to be something that they could recreate in their own homes. They had to go out. They had to participate in this community. They had a lot of success, especially in smaller centers, because in bigger centers, say like New Orleans, actually huge vampire scene out there, lots of competition for that audience, but in smaller centers, not so much. So they got great turnouts actually in small centers. And this is all intelligence and things, much like Phoebe's stand-up routine, where you're actually engaging with your audience in the real world to learn what it is they want and what is it they like, what do they respond to. So I'm really curious to see how this story continues to roll out and what happens with it.
There's this other element that occurs to me when you're talking about that, and that is audience participation. Old media, mass media kind of said, the audience should lie there on the couch eating potato chips and drooling. We'll do the rest. And like with Game of Thrones, even you're guessing, you're participating by trying to figure it out, and you're going to Bite Me movie to get dressed up and be part of the ball, right? So I think that's something like when we talk about engaging fans, it's really giving them something to do, a way to participate and be part of this world that they've fallen in love with.
Well, and I think the note that you made before about, how writers like want to be the sole author, they don't want to necessarily invite the audience in to co-create with them. The reality is the audience is very powerful and they can do that with or without you. So it's better if you can show up. Even happened in Star Wars back in the day. There were early fan films, frame by frame, faithful recreations, say with Lego animation of the movies by fans that, Lucas and company tried to shut down and then realized that eventually they had to let go. And that was even before the internet really had taken off.
In terms of engaging the audience, when I'm on the thing I'm writing now, as I read through it, I think to myself, where is the audience? What are they thinking? What do they know? What are they trying to figure out? Have I given them enough clues to get to the thing that I want them to know now? After this episode is over, what are they going to talk about with their friends? How are they going to speculate about the show? Because I want them to have something to think about, and I want to kind of prepare that user path through the show. So I think this is going pretty well so far. Well, I'm enjoying talking to you, Annalise. Looking ahead, I know we've kind of planned 7 more episodes of Story Plus Audience coming up, which will be our first season. And I thought we could talk just a little bit about what we're excited to get to next. And one of the things that really has me excited is episode 5, when we'll be talking a lot about fan culture. And, you know, it's a topic I love. I think when we understand how fans interact with a property and what elements really engage them, I think we can begin to put those kinds of elements into the stories we create and the story worlds we create, so that when the fans arrive, they have all the materials they want to play with.
Yeah, I love thinking and talking and learning about fandoms. I think, you know, a lot of what we just talked about in terms of our examples is a lot about the power for good and for bad of fandoms. And I think it is kind of, they are inevitable if you're doing your job right. So I'm eager to dig into that one too. I'm also really looking forward to our 6th episode, where we're going to discuss how to use this kind of approach of Story Plus Audience to get found. The word discoverability has been so huge in the Canadian arts and culture sector for the last few years, and is really being presented as this kind of magic bullet to solve the problem of connecting story to audience or creative work to audience. Definitely important, but I think I really would like to break that down a lot more. There's so much more to it than just how to satisfy the algorithms of the search engines, which is really how it's framed. I think the more you understand your audience and the discoverers in this discoverability model, the better, because you need to make that work for them.
I think, you know, one of the things that bothers me about the whole concept of discoverability is that it puts the work on the audience to discover you. And I think in this podcast, what we're trying to do is take the opposite approach and say, we can go out and find our audience and know where they are and begin to even build those connections with them even before the content comes out, so that they're, and bring it to them rather than forcing them to go look for us. And then the other episode I thought I would mention is episode 104, where we'll be talking about you as a creator, how you create a version of yourself to use in the social media, online, in interacting with your audience, how you create that.
I think as well, to frame it as almost a performance, you have this performance of your life. You don't have to give it all away online for it still to be really an effective tool. It's just a tool for you as a creative to connect with your audience. It's always been a part of the internet to create connections between people. That's where it started. So how we can leverage that, again, by being really strategic and about really thinking about who is the audience that we want to attract and engage to this performance that we're making online it's going to be fun. Look forward to it.
See, I already feel, you know, a sense of safety and relief. it'll be my social media therapy episode. So I've got this whole story and audience thing kind of beginning to percolate around in my head right now. And I got a bunch of different projects on the go at the moment. So how can I take what we're talking about now, and what's the first step I can take in my own work for the rest of this afternoon, for example?
Sure. Well, here's some homework for you and for our listeners. I think a good place to start is to take a look at all of those stories, all of those projects that you've got right now. And we're going to go from a place of the gut to start out with. We're going to back this with some more strategic thinking later on. But just as you're looking at the stories that you have in front of you at the moment, which do you think will generate the strongest feelings in an audience? You know, really digging down. We've given some pretty good examples of strong feelings that audiences have for story. So looking, you know, thinking about those examples, maybe that might help you frame your own work in terms of which would generate those strong feelings and connection. And then start to try to visualize who those people are. Who are those people that are going to feel those feelings? And what about your story are they going to care about the most? And I think that's a good jumping off point for a lot of the other things that we'll talk about over the next 7 episodes.
Okay, I have my work cut out for me now.
Yeah, well, I think it's a good place to start. So let's sort of wrap this up today. Thank you so much, everyone, for listening. If you found it helpful, please take a moment to rate, subscribe, and share on whichever platform you're listening to us on.
And if you want to reach Annalise or know more about her, check out veria.ca.
You can learn more about Jill and check her out at jillgolick.com. And that's Golick with one L, GOLICK.com.
And you can reach us both at story+audience@gmail.com. And that plus is spelled out PLUS. I'm Jill Golick.
I'm Annalise Larson. Again, thanks for listening. Now, go listen to your audience.